from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years after the desegregation of American schools, the black-white achievement gap in school performance still looms. But the race lens is not the only way of looking at the gap, and maybe not the right way. A new book argues that a fixation on race, school reform, and testing overlooks the real problem, poverty, and all that comes with it. Tonight on Point, social class, education, and tackling the real achievement gap. But first, earlier today, American soldiers and Iraqi police reportedly raided the offices and home of Ahmad Chalabi, America's once favorite politician in Iraq. The relationship between the Pentagon and Chalabi soured as the U.S. occupation became messier, and his criticism of the United States has grown more vocal. At a press conference after the raid, Chalabi condemned the action.
I am America's best friend in Iraq. If the CPA finds it necessary to direct an armed attack against my home, you can see the state of relations between the CPA and the Iraqi people.
Jim Walsh is at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government and joins me now. Jim, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening, Tom.
It's great to have you. Jim, what do you make of this extraordinary scene of the one-time very best buddy of the Pentagon having his home and offices, we understand, despite Donald Rumsfeld's equivocating, raided by American and Israeli forces?
Well, this is certainly a love affair that's gone bad. And if you watch that press conference today or any of Chalabi's aides spinning on the networks, the language is really ugly. I expect that Chalabi will be increasing his criticism of the U.S. as we go forward. And I think the causes are probably many. It may be that because Chalabi is being shut out of the transition process, remember the Iraqi Governing Council folks, the folks who thought they would be getting power, will not be getting power under the new UN plan.
Right.
They're probably feeling shut out and on the sidelines. And this is Chalabi trying to get back in the game, and Bremer probably trying to keep him out of the game.
So Chalabi has been making bad noises about the U.S. lately, but what could he have done that would be so offensive to Paul Bremer that they would send soldiers into his house and home? We've seen pictures of the place busted up, computers taken away, and all the rest. What could he have done that would bring that response?
Well, that's a great question, Tom. And, of course, this is a person with somewhat of a checkered past. He had been convicted of embezzlement after a Jordanian bank crashed in the 1980s, and he has, had various rumors associated with him. You'll remember, of course, that he and the Iraqi National Congress were the source of much of the false and misleading intelligence information about Iraq, particularly about its weapons of mass destruction program. Now, there are all sorts of rumors swirling around as to why they went to his compound early in the day. We had Pentagon spokespeople saying it was because of issues associated with the Oil for Food program, that UN program that has recently come under scrutiny. Later, a spokesperson for Ambassador Bremer denied that. So it's really unclear. All we know is that there is a judge who has issued a warrant for the arrest of some of Chalabi's aides, most especially his head of security, accusations of kidnapping, accusations of corruption. But at this point, we don't know, and there aren't many folks who are talking.
Michael Isikoff at Newsweek writes that Chalabi may have supplied neighboring Iran with intelligence on what's going on inside Iraq, cozying up perhaps to the Iranians as he felt the relationship with the Americans cooling. Does that make sense to you? And how much damage could he have done to U.S. interests if indeed he took that path?
Well, I think it's conceivable. I mean, if Chalabi is anything, he is a survivor, a nimble tactician. When it became apparent that he was not on the quick line to power in Iraq, he changed course and began, he was always a secular leader, and then began warming up to the Shiite community in Iraq and trying to act as a broker between the Shiites and the Americans over constitutional issues. It's conceivable that he has a back channel to Iran, again, a Shiite nation, but I really doubt that, and I doubt he'd do much damage to U.S. national interests. If anything, my guess is that what Bremer has decided to do is to try to clamp down on Chalabi now rather than let him continue and cause problems for the transition later. He's making a calculated bet that it's better to pay the upfront cost with all the bad publicity that this might generate and creating a new enemy at a time when it's a rather fragile and delicate transitional period. Better to do it now, he's thinking, than let Chalabi work behind the scenes to try to undermine the transition. Because remember, again, those folks on the Iraqi governing council thought they were on the fast track to leadership positions. That is not the UN plan. So that means that they don't have much of an interest in seeing the UN plan succeed. So maybe Bremer, and again, this is just speculation, yep, but maybe Bremer is saying, let's go ahead and shut this down because he's going to cause problems for us later on.
Much more to learn here. We'll keep watching. Jim Walsh, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Jim Walsh is executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He spoke with me from Boston. For decades, educators and policy wonks have acknowledged the achievement gap between students of different races and social classes. On average, white students' proficiency in reading and in math is almost twice that of black students, for example. Common sense says that school reform is the key to eliminating this gap. But after years of effort and, in some cases, improvement in overall averages, the gap remains. Talking about class makes most Americans uneasy. But a new book suggests that if we are serious about getting an equal education for America's children, we are going to have to face the realities and impact of stark class inequities. This hour on Point, class, not race, as the big issue in American education. Has it been convenient to reduce America's education problems to race? Is it bigger than race? Could it be about class? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Richard Rothstein. He's a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and a visiting lecturer at Teachers College at Columbia University. His new book is Class and Schools, Using Social, Economic, and Educational Reform to Close the Black-White Achievement Gap. Good evening and welcome, Richard Rothstein.
Good evening.
And we are also joined tonight by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hello, Jack.
Richard,
hello to everybody. Richard Rothstein, give us your case here. We've heard an awful lot about race this week with the Brown v. Board of Education 50th anniversary going by. You say it's not race, it's class. What do you mean?
Well, for the last any number of years, we've been concerned about the gap in achievement between black and white students, and it's almost universally concluded that this gap must be attributable to the fact that schools are not doing what they should be doing to educate black and low-income children.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm arguing in this book is that it's inconceivable that we could close the achievement gap between black and white children through school reform so long as we have such enormous social class differences in this society, such enormous differences in access to income, to wealth, to housing, to health care. All of these things directly affect the child's achievement.
But shouldn't the school be the solution to that? Take that child, put them in a wonderful school, give them books and learning and good instruction, and that's the way out of poverty. Isn't that the classic American story?
Well, that's what most people think. But what I try to do in this book is to show exactly how poverty works to make that a false solution or a solution that can't possibly work. Let me give you some examples.
Okay.
Take the area of health. We know that low-income children come to school with vision problems at twice the rate of middle-class children. Why is that? Well, partly because less adequate prenatal development has more of an effect on vision than it has on most health outcomes.
Okay.
Partly it's because low-income children have less adequate child care than middle-class children, so they spend much, much more time watching television, which doesn't train the eye to focus, to converge, to track, to do the other things that are necessary to read. Now, if you take two groups of children, one of whom has good vision and the other of whom has poor vision, and you give them both excellent instruction, you're still going to have an achievement gap between those two groups of children. And unless you do something to ensure that the vision problems of the low-income and minority children are corrected, no matter how good the instruction is, you're not going to be able to close that achievement gap.
So good schools plus regular visits to the optician.
Well, that's just an example. Regular visits to the optician, to the dentist, to the pediatrician, as well as a host of other solutions that have nothing to do with what schools can do. I'll give you another health example,
okay.
If I may.
Yeah.
It may seem to many people to be a trivial one, but I just read a report issued here in the state of Massachusetts this week showing the high rate of untreated dental cavities among poor and low-income children. The Surgeon General nationally found a few years ago that low-income children, 30% of them, had untreated dental cavities.
So what?
Now, what does that have to do with learning? Well, if you have untreated dental cavities, something that middle-class children typically do not have because they go to the dentist, you're likely to have, in some cases, a toothache. Let's say half the children who have untreated dental cavities have toothaches.
Mm-hmm.
If you give a test to two groups of children, one of whom has toothaches and the other of whom does not, the children who have the toothaches are going to score lower simply because they're going to be distracted by discomfort.
So they're sitting in math class thinking about the tooth and not about the math. This is raising so many issues. We'll get into them. But let me ask you first, does that leave you then talking about race at all? Or are you saying, let's look at education wholly through a class lens that would apply equally to all Americans of whatever race? This is a matter of family income.
Well, I'm not saying it's simply income. I'm saying that there are many ingredients of social class differences. Race is one of them in this country because black children have different histories. Black families have different histories in this country than white families. I'll give you an example. We typically compare low-income black and white children, and we're puzzled about the fact that even for low-income children, black children score lower than white children. And we're puzzled by the fact that for middle-class children, black children score lower than white children. It's not so hard to understand because black children and white children who are poor, both of whom come from poor families, are not really in similar economic circumstances. A poor white family is likely to have been poor for a much shorter period of time. White poverty is typically episodic in this country. A typical black poor family is likely to have been permanently poor. So if you compare two poor children, one of whom is white and one of whom is black, on average groups of children, with the same low income, the black children, on average, are going to be more disadvantaged than the white children.
But that seems to come right back around to race. I thought we were talking class, and class suggests something that you know, cuts through all racial lines.
Well, what I'm saying is that class differences are highly correlated with racial differences. That is, if you compared white children, and in the example I was just giving,
mm-hmm.
white children and black children,
yep.
both of whom were poor for long periods of time, whose families were permanently poor, you would find much less of a test score gap than you would if you simply compared poor children whose families were poor this year. Or let me give you an example from the middle class.
All right.
We're also puzzled about the fact that middle-class black children score lower than middle-class white children. Well, in the United States today, median family income of black families compared to white families is about 62%.
Okay.
Black families have median family income 62% of whites.
Mm-hmm.
But black median family assets are only 12% of whites. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that, for example, if you compare typical middle-class black children with typical middle-class white children, the white children's families are likely to have savings for college. They're likely to have more invested in their homes, they're likely to have pensions.
So why can't the kids still study the math at the same intensity?
Well, they can.
The
they can study the math at the same intensity. But if you take two groups of children, one of whom knows their family has savings for college, the other of whom knows they can't afford to go to college, and both study as intensively, or teachers try to get them to study as intensively, the group that knows it has a college fund waiting for them is likely to put more effort into school than the group that knows that they're not going to be able to go to college or be able to go only with much greater difficulty.
Jack Beatty, jump in here with us. I'm trying. There's so much that's being pulled up here. Richard Rothstein talks about class. I'm hearing culture in here. Class, culture, race, where's the thread?
I guess the thread is inequality, that some people just get a very bad shake from the educational system, and that often those people share things in common, race and income over time. Richard Sennett, the late Richard Sennett, wrote a wonderful book, The Hidden Injuries of Class, and more we have to see these educational issues through that lens. because I believe not only does it help us see the real problem with the black-white achievement gap, it offers us a way beyond that that is really an anti-poverty program for blacks and whites.
Well, the implications are big. We're looking at class, not race, as the big issue in the unequal quality of American education. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about class, not race, as the big issue in the unequal quality of American education. My guest tonight is Richard Rothstein. He's research associate at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and author of Class and Schools, Using Social, Economic, and Educational Reform to Close the Black-White Achievement Gap. You can join us tonight. Is social class a bigger factor than race in American student achievement? Has it been convenient to reduce the problem to race? Is it bigger than race? And hard as it is school reform then going to be enough, or are we kidding ourselves? Will it take social reform to raise a nation of well-educated students? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let me go to Laura calling from Gay Mills, Wisconsin. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling from the perspective of an educator. I've been in the field of education for about 30 years, and in my experience, it's been pretty much across the board in terms of race and class.
Okay, you've seen it all.
Yeah, I have pretty much.
Okay.
I would agree with this premise. I would additionally add that I think I have noticed that there's actually quite a bit of cultural difference, even within whites, between those who are of higher class and those who are of lower class. So I don't think the cultural differences are entirely between races,
mm-hmm.
and so I think that's a factor.
Certainly.
And one of the things that brought it home to me was recently I viewed the film from the 60s called Up the Down Staircase.
Sure.
And what it really brought home to me was this issue of class, because there were children in, I remember, we used to call them slums rather than ghettos, because it was about class, not about race.
Mm-hmm.
There were people of a variety of races who all lived in these areas of the city where poor people lived. And that was the kind of school that was pictured in this film.
So give us an example from your 30 years of teaching, Laura, of how you've seen this demonstrated in children that you've taught, where you said there's a problem here, it's not racial, it's class.
Right. Well, I would say, and again, I'll say that there is a culture of class. We often think of cultures only as corresponding with nationalities or races, but I think there is a particular culture that goes along with class, and that relates to the kinds of experiences that children will bring to the school with them and be the sort of starting point from which a teacher works.
Yep.
And that's really different. And I think most prominently by class rather than by race.
Well, there's an affirmation of the premise from somebody who ought to know after 30 years. Laura, thanks for calling. Richard Rothstein, I'm still struggling just a little. I want to get to some of your prescriptions for how to deal with this, because they must be mind-bogglingly large. But are you saying, I still don't quite understand, are you saying then that it is only minorities who are truly low class?
No, not at all.
Uh-huh.
Not at all. What I'm saying is that the achievement gap between blacks and whites is primarily a gap between lower-class and middle-class children, because
mm-hmm.
blacks, on average,
yep.
have lower social status and economic status than white children. I'm certainly not saying that there are no racial differences. What I'm saying is that the racial differences can be explained by looking at the different economic and social circumstances that average, typical black children grow up in compared to those that typical white children grow up in.
So if that's the starting point, you go on to say then that school reform and testing and everything we've been pouring our focus into and resources, enough or not, can be debated another time. You're saying school reform doesn't cut it, doesn't scratch this itch.
That's right. Scratch, I'm not sure. But I would say that school reform alone is not going to close the gap. And if we expect school reform alone to close the gap, we're bound to be disappointed and indeed disillusioned with our public schools. They can't possibly close the gap so long as these vast differences exist.
But I'm almost overwhelmed at the suggestion then that's implicit here. You're saying the only way to get equal education for kids is to what? Is to make a class-free society? Is to redistribute American income radically? What are you suggesting?
Well, you know, it's curious. you react against the idea of a class-free society.
Oh no, I'm not against at the magnitude of the challenge.
Well, but think about the magnitude of the challenge that we're setting for ourselves by expecting schools to do it. What we say that schools are going to do is have all children graduate from high school with the same level of high proficiency. That's a class-free society, but we expect it to be produced by schools. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is you cannot produce a class-free society from schools. You need to do something to equalize the conditions in which children come to school.
And how would you begin to do that?
I think there are some obvious ways to do it, and many industrialized countries do a much better job than we do. So it's not that difficult to conceive. Mm-hmm. For example, mm-hmm. we could treat the vision problems, the dental problems, the health problems of low-income children in a consistent way, and that would improve their achievement.
So get health care out there to everybody, for starters.
Get health care out there to everybody. I'll give you another example. One of the biggest problems that we have in urban, low-income, minority schools in this country is high student mobility. There are some schools in cities like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles which have 100%, 200% mobility rates. That means for every seat in the school, there are 2 to 3 children sitting in that seat at some time during the year.
In other words, poor families moving often.
That's right.
What are you going to do about that?
Well, let me just make this point. Is that no matter how good the school is, you're not going to get the same kind of achievement from children who are moving in and out of the classroom as you are from stable children.
Right.
Now, just last week or 2 weeks ago, the Bush administration announced that it was cutting back the Section 8 housing voucher program.
Mm-hmm.
This is a program that provides subsidies to working families with children. This is not a welfare program, who are living in cities where rents are rising much faster than their wages.
Okay, so that would make it worse, but we've had Section 8 for a long time, and you're still talking about 200% turnover.
Section 8 has never been fully funded, so that it's only about one-third of the families who are eligible for Section 8 actually get vouchers because not enough money is appropriate.
My point is the cutbacks you're saying might make it worse, but what you're suggesting is a lot more money, not just for health, but for housing.
Yes, and I'm saying this is not an inconceivable idea to fund the Section 8 housing voucher program.
Mm-hmm.
It would do a lot to improve achievement. In fact, I would bet that if you did some of these health care reforms that I'm talking about and provided adequate housing for working families with children in urban areas, you get a bigger test score bump than you would for many of the school reforms that we bandy about so frequently.
Okay, health, housing, what else is on your list?
Well, the questioner from Wisconsin a few minutes ago talked about the culture of different social classes, and that's a very important issue. It's not that difficult to understand. If you think of it this way, if you have a family whose parents are professionals, they go to work every day, their work involves solving problems, being creative, coming up with new ways to approach issues, collaborating with their fellow employees. Compare that with a working-class family whose parents go to work and they work either in a factory or in a store and they're doing service work.
Okay.
And their work consists of following orders and procedures that have been set out for them. Those two families raise their children differently. The first family raises their children by asking questions, by teaching them to figure out things by themselves, by being trying to invent creative ways of doing things. The second family is likely to raise their children more by giving them instructions.
That's deep in the wool. How do you change that?
Well, the only way you can change it is by giving lower-class children access to more high-quality child care, for example, to early childhood programs which are staffed by professional adults, professionals who speak the kind of language that highly educated people speak, the kind of upbringing in early childhood that middle-class children get.
So send a kind of super child care into poor neighborhoods.
Yes, I think that's one way of describing it.
And this just the beginning of the list. Jack Beatty, Americans talk a lot about equal education, but when you begin to pick it up at the level that Richard Rothstein is here and describe this kind of very thoroughgoing solutions, it makes me wonder how genuine that talk about equal education is, how much hypocrisy is there if this is what it would really take to provide that.
Yes, there's kind of an education illusion, and it has to do with the idea of merit, that, we sit down, we take a test, the test is a test of our merit, and if we work hard enough, we pass the test.
But, you know, another way of looking at merit is that it's luck in slow motion. That is, it's the luck of who your parents were. It's the luck of who their parents were. It's the luck of your health. It's all of these factors that, frankly, don't have a lot to do with you as a personality. But we see things in that individualistic way. And education, the way it's set up, encourages that. You know, I did well on the test. You didn't do well on the test. That's not adequate to deal with the deficits that people have when they approach school. And these are deficits that not just poor black children have. They're deficits that if you go into the mountains of West Virginia, you're going to find. You're going to find it any place where these characteristics of long-term poverty and disadvantage prevail. And, you know, one of the things that can be done and that has been measured to work is to mix classes in schools. According to the Century Foundation, a middle-class school is 24 times likely to be consistently high-performing than a high-poverty school. And if you put and low-income students in middle-class schools score better than middle-class students in the highest poverty schools.
So you want a new kind of busing, Jack? Is that what that suggests?
Well, I mean, the reasons are not hard to figure out. Middle-class schools spend more, $7,500 per pupil versus $6,200 in the poverty districts. Middle-class schools more likely to spend more on the classroom than on the bureaucracy. They have an orderly environment and so on. All these reasons. And, you know, leaving cities to solve this problem within their population base has always been sort of going at the thing with one hand tied behind your back. So long as this decision of the Supreme Court, the Millikan decision of the late 70s, prevails, the suburbs are not part of what is really a national effort. After all, equality was the commitment made after the Civil War in the 14th Amendment. Equal protection of the laws was the commitment made by the whole country to the freedmen, but to black people in general. And we don't honor that commitment if we essentially say, well, because of artificial boundaries of I'm in Newton and you're in Boston, sorry. That's not how to deal with this, with a national problem. And unfortunately, that Supreme Court decision is there like a lion on the path of the creative solutions that could be devised.
Jack, Richard Rothstein, let me bring another perspective in here. Joining us from Silver Spring, Maryland, is Krista Kafer. She's a senior policy analyst for education at the Heritage Foundation. The foundation has identified 21 what they call no-excuses schools that have high poverty but are still successful. Welcome, Krista Kafer.
Hi, it's so good to be here.
It's good to have you. So we're hearing the case tonight that it's all about class at bottom, not about race. You've got a project that seems to be designed to fly right in the face of that, even the name, No Excuses. Does this all sound like excuses to you, the notion of class factors burdening kids so they can't learn well?
Well, I think it's no secret that kids from high-poverty homes come to school with challenges, challenges that many middle-class students don't have. They may come in with a smaller vocabulary, single parents, high television watching, and other cultural and economic factors. And they come into school with these challenges. So what that challenges the school then to do is, what can you do in 8 hours that makes a difference? And one thing that we found is that some schools are doing what it takes to make a difference. Our Samuel Casey Carter, a couple years ago, did the No Excuses book for the Heritage Foundation, and it profiles, it's basically snapshots of 21 schools serving predominantly poor children that have above average academic achievement. And all but three of these schools are public schools. And they found that each of these schools were making a significant difference.
So are you saying then, contrary to Richard Rothstein's view, that it can, in fact, all be done in the schools, if the schools just pulled their socks up, school reform is the way?
Well, I think it's analogous to this. You know, if you look at hospitals, for instance, now can a hospital cure every single person? No. But clearly, a hospital with great leadership, best practices, high standards, great staff is going to make a difference. And that's what we found with these schools, is that with good leadership, good teachers, a strong back-to-basics curriculum, a focused environment, high expectations, and rigorous testing, that they were able to make a difference with these kids. And we're not the only ones. There's a Pacific Research Institute recently did one, a similar profile, called They Have Overcome, where they looked at schools exclusively in California that were doing the same.
Let me pick that up with Richard Rothstein. Richard Rothstein, what do you say? Pull up the socks and they'll be more or less fine. It can be done in the schools with enough effort.
Well, I think one of the most disturbing things about the kind of debate we have in this country is the ease with which we equate making a difference, schools that can make a difference, and schools that can close the test score gap.
Mm-hmm.
I have no doubt that there are good schools, better schools. Some schools are better than others. Some schools make more of a difference than others. But we glide very easily from that observation into the conclusion that we can close the test score gap or close the achievement gap by schools alone. I don't think any of the schools that the Heritage Foundation profiles can close the achievement gap. There are some. I've actually spent some time studying this report of the Heritage Foundation, and some of the schools they describe are quite good schools,
mm-hmm.
but they are not models for the kind of national problem that we've got of the big achievement gap between average black students and average white students.
Why not?
Well, you have to look at each of the 21 schools, but let me just give you a couple of examples. There was one school they profiled in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was a high-poverty school. I looked into that school. It was high poverty. Most of the students there were getting free and reduced-price lunches. But the reason that this was a high-poverty school is because most of the children were children of graduate students at MIT and Harvard whose stipends were low.
That's
so they
different.
Were eligible for free and reduced-price lunches.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good school. It had high test scores. It's not a model for how to close the black-white achievement gap.
Krista Kafer, I've just got you for another couple of minutes. Let me ask you, to Richard's kind of assertion here, that this, yes, it could make a difference, but it won't close the gap. As an American, and considering the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law, at the Heritage Foundation, are you honestly committed to the idea of equal education, of equal achievement as the measure of that equal education, or is, you know, good enough or better good enough?
Well, one thing that people are exploring now with equality, particularly around the Brown decision, is equality of opportunity. And if I could just take a step back, I know that I'm sure that Richard has talked about the Coleman Report, or a series of Coleman reports that date back several decades, that Coleman showed that, you know, just as his book makes clear, that parenting and other kinds of factors outside of school really make a huge difference. But Coleman also found out that Catholic schools had better achievement with poor kids, had better results with poor kids than other schools. So what I think that says is, you know, what kinds of opportunities can we give kids in the inner city, kinds of equal opportunities we can give so that they can soar?
We've got half a minute left. Can you go to this question? Are you at the Heritage Foundation committed to equal education as measured by equal outcomes?
We are committed to equal opportunity for all students, and that comes out of giving school choice policies, vouchers, charter schools, and other things that give parents the ability to pick the best schools for their children.
Krista Kafer, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
Krista Kafer, Senior Policy Analyst for Education at the Heritage Foundation. We are talking tonight about class, not race, as the big issue in the unequal quality of American education. My guest is Richard Rothstein, author of the new book, Class and Schools, Using Social, Economic, and Educational Reform to Close the Black-White Achievement Gap. You can join us. Is class the dirty little secret of education inequity in America? Or is this a way to duck school reform with an unreachable liberal agenda? If it's not about class, why do people kill themselves to live in affluent towns with blue-ribbon schools? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about class, not race, as the big issue in the unequal quality of American education. My guest is Richard Rothstein, author of the new book, Class and Schools. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is social class a bigger factor than race in American student achievement? If we're honest with ourselves, will it take social reform to raise a nation of well-educated, maybe even equally educated students? And could you work two jobs at minimum wage and still raise a prize young reader, a science fair champ, a prize-winning physicist? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jackie's calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple of comments. One is, there is research that shows that even when you equalize for socioeconomic status, black children underachieve at every level.
What children?
Black children.
Black children, all right, okay.
So whereas I agree that the best predictor of a child's educational success is actually the mother's educational level, obviously a class factor, there is something added going on with black children. There's some added burden that black children bear. And I say this as an educator, as a mother of black children, and also as somebody who works with black children from high-achieving schools, really seeking to help them attain the level of the rest of their peers.
And what do you think that factor is, Jackie?
There have been a series of studies that seem to point to several things, teacher expectations being one, black parents not demanding the same kind of access to high, challenging, rigorous courses for their kids that white parents do being another, the culture that black children live with, where right to do well educationally, is a third. There are a number of different factors.
So do you think those things could be addressed with better health care, with high-quality child care, with the kind of solutions that Richard Rothstein is describing?
No. They really need a separate focus in order to close the black-white achievement gap. Now, I value the things that he's suggesting. I think those things are really needed. I think they're more difficult than school reform. If we're having such a struggle with school reform, and I certainly think that better trained teachers would be a huge improvement for poor black kids.
Yep.
But I think that if we're struggling so hard with those things, how will we ever get to all the other things that he's proposing?
Jackie, stick with me for a minute. I want to put that and get Richard Rothstein's response. Richard.
Yes. Well, she made a couple of very interesting points that I would like to respond to. First, she said that when you control for socioeconomic status, there's still a black-white achievement gap. And this is something I talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
She is correct, except that the way in which we control for socioeconomic status is usually so primitive that we exaggerate the gap. So, for example, when you compare, as I said earlier, black and white children of the same current income level,
right,
you get a big achievement gap. But if you were to compare black and white children of the same economic circumstances, taking account not only of their current income level, but of how long they were at that income, of their family assets, of the health care that they have, and all of the variety of factors that would go into a true measure of social status, you would find a much smaller black-white achievement gap. Now, I'm not saying it would disappear entirely. I don't know that it would. But what we do know is when we add more and more of these factors into it, it narrows much, much more than most of the popular discussion of this acknowledges.
So you can dispute some of the interpretation there, yet you can hear a kind of organic understanding that Jackie's bringing to the table. How do you speak to it?
Well, as I say, I'm not suggesting that there would be no achievement gap.
We got that.
But let's try to figure out why there is still some achievement gap. We know, for example, that black high school graduates and white high school graduates with the same test scores, that is, I'm not talking about people who graduate from good high schools or bad high schools. Black high school graduates and white high school graduates with the same test scores don't have the same earnings. Blacks earn less than whites do with the same test scores and the same high school attainment. One of the things we know is that there's discrimination still in the labor market. A study that was just done about a year ago sent out black and white college students who are posing as high school students, as high school graduates, rather, applying for jobs. Some of them had identical resumes when they applied for these jobs, but some listed a drug conviction and jail time served.
Mm.
The whites with jail time served got more callbacks, a higher proportion of callbacks for job interviews than the blacks with clean records. High school graduates with the same test scores. Now, again, you take two groups of students, one white, one black, same test scores, same ability, same academic achievement. The one that knows that high school is that their work in school is going to pay off is likely to put more effort into school than the group that knows that it's not going to pay off.
Let me turn back to our caller, Jackie, for just a minute. Jackie, does this perspective sound like it's getting at the problem you're identifying?
I think that it is part of the problem because I think this residual discrimination is tied to teacher expectation, which so I see the two things as being parallel. I think that begins to address the problem, but I think that there is a cultural problem. One of your earlier callers talked about the cultural difference between classes, which I think is on the face of it obvious.
Yes.
There is also a cultural issue with black kids. And it's interesting that if you look at immigrants, if you look at Africans or if you look at Caribbean immigrants,
yeah,
tend to perform better.
So what's your solution? What's your idea for where to go? Okay, better teachers, we got that, but what else?
Better teachers, more attention to this question about teacher expectation for black kids, and some self-help, some stuff that I think we as black people have to do about the expectations that our kids have for their own lives.
Inside the house. Jackie, thank you so much for your call. Call again. Let me get another call on here. John is calling from Conneaut, Ohio. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I would like to say, as a 55-year-old, middle-class, white male, I've been to college, raised three children. I think the biggest problem with education is neither race nor class, but the drug culture, which has been around since the 60s. It is glorified in the media, in TV, movies.
And was it an issue for your children, John, or you're saying it's an issue for other people's children?
It's an issue for my children, for other people's children. There is a very real and thriving culture centered around drugs, around doing your own thing, things that were started in the 60s and possibly even before that, but...
We got it. And you're saying that lets the air out of the tires as well. Richard Rothstein, what about drugs? A factor in itself? A part of the matrix you're describing?
I don't think so. I mean, there's certainly drug problems in American society and among high school students, but I don't know that there's any reason to believe that drugs are more of a problem for black children than for white children, and that it's a cause of the achievement gap.
Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, well, what is so is the presence of gangs and violence. Middle-class schools report disorder problems, according to the Century Foundation, about half as often as high-poverty schools, and low-income kids are about twice as likely to report street gangs at school as more affluent students. So disorder is a bigger problem for lower-class kids.
Richard Rothstein, we've got about a minute left. If you could do everything you'd like to do to address this problem, what would it cost? Is it affordable? Could it be done if the commitment were there?
Well, if the commitment were there, it could be done. One thing I would do is immediately lower expectations into thinking that any of these things can close the achievement gap in a few years. But we need to have a multifaceted approach. We need to both reform schools, improve schools. We need to direct attention to our housing and health and income distribution policies, and we need to provide the kinds of quality experiences in early childhood and after school and in the summertime for lower-class children that middle-class children have. We need to do all three of those things if we want to make progress in narrowing the achievement gap.
A big agenda, but maybe that's what it takes to be serious about that gap. Richard Rothstein, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Richard Rothstein, research associate at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and author of the new book, Class and Schools, Using Social, Economic, and Educational Reform to Close the Black-White Achievement Gap. Jack Beatty, does the United States of America, circa 2004, have the stuff, the stomach, to take on that kind of challenge?
I don't know, but we're paying for it, aren't we? I mean, we're finding out every day that we're having a difficult time competing with other countries, our productivity, our educational level. We're having to import higher skill workers. So this is becoming an economic problem. That's how schools were invented in the first place, because businessmen decided we had to have an educated workforce. Maybe they'd decide to do that again, and we'd actually have some pressure from even well-off white people to spend money on programs that could really make a difference.
Might make a happy country, too. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, rock singer Bono's effort to get Africa's poverty problem back on the nation's radar. This is On Point. Against the backdrop of an ongoing war on terror and a messy war in Iraq, rock star Bono has spent much of the week calling for a war on AIDS and poverty in Africa. On Tuesday, Bono testified before the Senate Appropriations Committee, saying the attention of the world might sometimes be elsewhere, but history is watching. On Monday, he delivered the keynote address at the University of Pennsylvania's commencement ceremony, telling the class of 2004 that, quote, every era has its struggle, and the fate of Africa is one of ours. Here's an excerpt from Bono's address delivered Monday in Philadelphia.
There's a really great, truly great Irish poet. His name is Brendan Kennelly. And he has this epic poem. It's called The Book of Judas. And there's a line in that poem that never leaves my mind. It says, if you want to serve the age, betray it. What does that mean, to betray the age? Well, to me, betraying the age means exposing its conceits, its foibles, its phony moral certitudes. It means telling the secrets of the age and facing harsher truths. Every age has its massive moral blind spots. We might not see them, but our children will. Slavery was one of them, and the people who best served that age were the ones who called it as it was, which was ungodly and inhuman. Segregation, there was another one. America sees this now, but it took a civil rights movement to betray their age. And 50 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court betrayed the age. May 17, 1954, it says here, Brown versus Board of Education came down and put the lie to the idea that separate can ever really be equal. Amen to that. Fast forward 50 years. What are the ideas right now worth betraying? What are the lies we tell ourselves now? What are the blind spots of our age? It might be something simple. It might be something as simple as our deep down refusal to believe that every human life has equal worth. Could that be it? Could that be it? Each of you will probably have your own answer, but for me, that is it. And for me, the proving ground has been Africa. Africa makes a mockery of what we say, at least what I say, about equality. It questions our pieties and our commitments, because there's no way to look at what's happening over there and its effect on all of us and conclude that we actually consider Africans as our equal before God. There is no chance. Equality for Africa is a big idea. It's a big, expensive idea. Wishing for the end to AIDS and extreme poverty in Africa is like wishing that gravity didn't make things so damn heavy. We can wish it, but what the hell can we do about it? Well, more than we think. We can't fix every problem. Corruption, natural calamities are part of the picture here. But the ones we can, we must. The fact is that this generation, yours, my generation, we're the first generation that could look at poverty and disease, look across the ocean to Africa and say with a straight face, we can be the first to end the sort of stupid extreme poverty where in a world of plenty a child can die for lack of food in its belly. It's a fact. It's a fact. The economists confirm it. It's an expensive fact, but cheaper than, say, the Marshall Plan that saved Europe from communism and fascism. And cheaper, I would argue, than fighting wave after wave of terrorism's new recruits. That's the economics department over there. Very good. It's a fact, so why aren't we pumping our fists in the air and cheering about it? Well, probably because when we admit we can do something about it, we've got to do something about it. For the first time in history, we have the know-how, we have the cash, we have the life-saving drugs, but do we have the will?
Rockstar Bono delivering the commencement address at the University of Pennsylvania this week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.